Right now, though, it is time for the Media Beat. It is time for us to bring in none other than David Tarachuk. David joins us here on a Friday morning. And we also rebroadcast David over the course of the weekend and also after our noontime news. But let's bring him in right now. Good morning, David. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm in good health, I'm glad to say. I'm reporting healthily and heartily from the media capital of the world, New York City. And yes, it's another eventful media week, isn't it?
It's, well, you know, what's, I let people know when I first came on this morning. Well, I have an iPhone, and I also have whatever the Android phone, and I have them set to receive weather bulletins, news bulletins, and stuff like that. And so last night about 1 o'clock, I heard one phone go off with a buzz. And so I said, that's got to be just someone posting a comment on Facebook. But then within about 10 within about 10 seconds, there was So at 1 o'clock, I got up and I read that the President of the United States and the First Lady of the United States tested positive for COVID-19. So I went on and I put together a report, put it on our website and our Facebook page. But by the time I had finished that at about 20 after 1, comments had already started flooding Facebook. And I actually had to tell people, you know, listen, hey, you can dislike somebody for their politics. You can dislike somebody and want to vote against them because they're running. You can not like them for a lot of reasons. But you never, never, never wish a disease on somebody. And that's the way I feel. I mean, I don't agree with the President of the United States 99.9% of the time. He is the president, and he's a human being. And I know, you know, people want to jump on my back for this, but you just don't wish on this because, David, I mean, and I'm going to take your input on this because the first thing I thought about was, okay, so the president is tested positive for COVID-19. Over the past week, he has met with senators. He has met with his pick for the Supreme Court. He has met with countless people. How is the United States government, the Senate, and the House going to move forward right now? Because the contact tracing that's going to go on has got to be very, very unbelievable, and it is going to involve people from obviously the House and the Senate. I mean, this could be a quagmire where the House and the Senate and our government really gets laid to rest for about 14 to 20 days.
Yeah, the implications are extraordinary. Just in terms of public health management, you're right. I mean, the kind of contact tracing and then isolation of people who may need isolating in a consequence of having been in contact with someone who's tested positive, that almost boggles the mind when you consider the catchment area. The senators, as you say, the other members of Congress, senior White House staff, members of the cabinet, perhaps. And yes, you're quite right. We shouldn't wish ill of anyone who's diagnosed or at least testing positive for a disease. But at the same time, I think we need to set it in some context. I mean, every one of those meetings that you're suggesting the President of the United States had with other people and therefore necessitates checking out of their health as well, were conducted without a mask in very many cases. It's very rare that we saw the president wearing a mask. And of course, we can't really vouch for how much social distancing was practiced in any of those meetings. Some of the photographs and the video of his encounters are well within the prescribed distance of 6 feet. So it's hard not to factor into one's assessment of this situation a quality of of the president's leadership, which has been characteristic throughout his almost 4 years in office, and that's sheer fecklessness. It's not that he brought the disease on himself, but maybe it is possible to argue that that's exactly what he did. And I'm sure lots of people will be arguing that as we move on towards November 3rd. And who knows? I mean, we can rampantly speculate about what could happen in the next 33 days. But for the first 14 days, we know that the president will be not exactly out of action necessarily, but he will certainly be incapable of adopting the profile that he so clearly relies upon. My first thought was, will he be okay for the debate on the 15th of October? Who knows? But of course, much more immediately than that, and I'm sure probably top of mind in his own mind, is the fact that tonight and tomorrow he was planning yet more of his mass rallies, which are distinctly infection-prone because mask wearing and social distancing is just not part of the process there.
Yeah, and what's even more interesting about this is I look at the information that's coming out now, that the information about Hope Hicks actually surfaced at the White House a couple of days ago. And here's where exactly where you're – what I don't understand and where you're right. The White House had a plan in effect to keep – the president away from COVID-19. It's obvious they didn't follow protocols in the West Wing or the East Wing with the First Lady. And then you think about the First Lady and you think about her staff and then her protection from the Secret Service. You think about Donald Trump and then, yeah, you think about the political side of it. But once again, you think once again about the Secret Service, the details that follow him. This is just a... All you can say is it's another unbelievable event that has happened in the year 2020, and what do you think happens now with the hearings for the coronavirus aid bill? The Congress has come up with something. You've got the Supreme Court justice, and I don't see how really that can get together within the next 14 days. I mean, this is really a paralyzing effect, and you wonder, what the hell happened with planning to protect the President of the United States from this virus?
Well, it's hard to protect someone who, in essence, feels that he's somehow invulnerable. I think that goes for many things in this presidency. I know it's a bad joke to be making in the circumstances, but it's often said about this president that he's his own worst enemy. And then, of course, the immediate chorus is, oh, well, no, not when there's all these other people around. He has not led an administration which makes sound sense when it comes to, you would think, a top priority for that administration, which is keeping its own ranks, particularly its topmost rank, in place. All of the speculation may be totally irrelevant because it's perfectly possible for people to be tested and found positive for COVID and yet not develop symptoms. He may be in that fortunate category. When you count in the undeniable risk factors, that might seem unlikely, but it's possible. We know the risk factors. He's 74 years old. He's clinically obese. Both of these are reckoned to worsen your chances considerably. And therefore, we're in a situation where, of course, we don't know, but there are people in positions of effective management or ineffective management, in this case, you might say, who have the responsibility for planning for whatever outcome may be coming down the pike. And it's obviously, as you say, extremely difficult to know what in hell can actually happen. Maybe everything has to go, in some sense at least, has to go on pause for 14 days. But of course, the work that needs to be done in the meantime of contact tracing and isolation of anyone else who may come up testing positive because of this infection surge, if you like, this mini mini outbreak in the, you know, at the very pinnacle of our country's governance, is going to be extremely hard to conduct in an orderly way because of all the variables involved.
You know, I was also thinking about Donald Trump has always been known as a gambler, as with other people's money, but still a gambler. And really, I think, once again, he took a position that was a gamble. That COVID wouldn't be as bad as it would hope, as people thought, and that by the time the election came around, the economy would be turned around and everything like that. That gamble obviously has not paid off. But I just still sit here, and I know what I do, David. I'm not afraid of getting COVID-19, but I am 67. I am overweight. I did have bronchitis where I missed a year of school. I have a scarred lungs. So I limit my contact outside. I wear a mask. I stay 6 feet away from people. But I go about my normal life. I do go to shops, but I make sure I follow those rules. And that's what I don't understand, why even the Secret Service just didn't try to get across to the president that, you know, you're the president of the United States. You can't just do this stuff.
Well, as you say, the man has been a fairly reckless gambler in his time, with many issues, his real estate projects, his casinos, and of course his record of winning, despite what he may say, the objective record shows that he gambled and lost in many, many cases. The number of bankruptcies is testimony to that. The idea that you can gamble with anything if you want to, but there's a kind of there is a very clear responsibility if you're the chief executive of any institution, in this case the most powerful nation in the world. You have a responsibility to take care of yourself at an absolute minimum. And, you know, the parallels do abound. I mean, if we just to stick to the political realm, in my old home country, the chief executive there, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, tested positive and had a relatively minor case of coronavirus to begin with, and in a pattern which is not unusual. In fact, some experts say, in a sense, it can be seen as the classic progression of this disease. very little effect initially can suddenly, the condition of the patient can suddenly crater dramatically after about 10 days. If you remember, that's exactly what happened with Boris Johnson, and he was rushed into the ICU and, as we know, of course, recovered well. But for a time, it was extremely serious for that particular individual. And we've also been hearing recently interesting bits of reporting from inside that ICU, other patients who were there with him at the time. And it was, as it should be, I guess, a situation that everyone was taking very seriously. Now, coming out of that, Boris Johnson seemed in some ways a changed man. He was humbled by this experience and spoke in a way that would support that notion that he was humbled. However, his actions thereafter kind of wasted an opportunity, in a sense. He had a massive sympathy, spike in the sympathy vote, if you like. People began to think much better of him in the British electorate as he recovered and got back to business. But I'm afraid his equally contradictory, erratic governing of the COVID crisis, his management of it, or mismanagement of it, or non-management of it, has lost him all that sympathy, and his approval ratings are now sinking dramatically. So I think there's something about a denialist, I think, of any kind, who courts disaster when it becomes clear to everyone around that that what he's denying is in fact true, that coronavirus is serious, it can afflict any one of us, and while the degrees of it vary enormously, it can be extremely serious, and of course is. This week we have seen the terrible biomarker of 1 million deaths worldwide. So anyone who has tried to take this pandemic less than totally seriously is, I think, going to be punished by events. And maybe I venture to suggest that's what's happening here.
Do you think this will have any impact on the people who claim their civil rights are damaged when they're asked or told to wear masks? Or do you think that you kind of hope an event like this will unpoliticize something like this, but also in this day and age, it can even politicize it even more.
Well, who knows? When you're dealing with a position which is based on utter irrationality, then I don't think anything's going to make much difference to it in terms of factual developments. Though, yes, I mean, it ought to. It ought to give everyone pause. I'm prone to forgetfulness. I sometimes step out of the door and don't have my mask on, and it takes me a little while to remember that I'm walking, you know, maybe 20 yards, 50 yards into the street without my mask, and I turn around and go back and get it. But I have a feeling I'm not going to forget it today. I'm almost as old as the president. I shouldn't be taking any risks. And you know, whether it changes the politicization of the pandemic safety measures, that's a totally open question. But I veer to the pessimistic side. I don't think it's going to change. There are many people, at least, whose minds on this issue will not be changed, if you could even call it an issue. It's a kind of knee-jerk tribal response, I think, of saying, you know, as I heard someone actually saying last week, who's in that category of non-mask wearers, he said his defense of it was quite simple, almost ridiculously stupid, if you think about it. He said, "I'm not afraid of a disease," as if it was some mark of courage. And as I say, I don't think the practitioners of this unhealthy practice are open to much rationality.
Yeah, no, and also what most people forget is that the mask is not there really to prevent you from getting it from somebody else. It's to prevent from you giving it to somebody else.
Right. It's a basic fundamental issue, a fundamental element of public health. Yeah.
All right. We let this dominate the conversation here. You must have come into today, or is it like me? Did this topic just replace everything that you might want to have talked about?
No. I noticed that, the events that the media have to report on do go on anyway, although, of course, this has jangled everybody's nerves, I think. But I've been looking for good examples, you know, examples of good journalistic practice, as I try to every week. I don't want to be a mean-minded media critic all the time. And for the slot that we're calling Find the Good and Praise It, I have a very prime and wonderfully successful candidate, I think, this week. Could we have the fanfare, please? Yeah, the fanfare is for a young journalist, a remarkable, meteorically rising young journalist in Britain. He works for possibly the most well-known newspaper in Britain, The Times, one of the world's oldest newspapers, in its time known as The Thunderer for the impact of its stentorian leading articles, its editorials. But this young man is called Henry Zeffman. He has had, as I say, a remarkable meteoric rise. He was the winner of an award, which rather touched me, when he was still a student. He won the Young Journalist Award of the Year in Britain, which is actually named for a man called Anthony Howard. In some ways, in some quarters, it's just known as the Anthony Howard Award. Anthony Howard, Tony Howard, was one of the best editors I have ever worked for. He commissioned articles from me in two magazines that he edited, national magazines. One called the weekly political magazines. One is called The Listener, which is owned by the BBC, no longer alive, I'm afraid, and The New Statesman, a very prominent, leading, in fact, political weekly, tinging to the left, more than tinging, I should say, which is still going, and is still a very powerful voice in the world of British journalism. He got that award when, as I say, he was still a student himself. And part of the prize of that was some cash involved, but also the prize was to enjoy a fellowship at three different institutions. One, The Observer, the oldest newspaper in the world, and still a very fine paper, The New Statesman itself, and also The Times, where he eventually got hired and he became a political correspondent. And now he is I haven't had time to check this out, but possibly the youngest ever Washington correspondent, Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Times. And it's about that I want to really fanfare Zeffman's extraordinary political capacity as a journalist. Political reporting of the finest order has come out this week from Zeffman in the pages of The Times. It's essentially a massive investigation presented graphically into the crucial question of what happens if the election goes against Trump, in view of everything that he's been saying of a disturbing nature about whether or not he'll accept such a result, and whether or not he's prepared to tell his supporters to be calm while the count is going on, all those questions. So it's a fundamentally powerful piece of analytical journalism. It essentially goes through neatly, clearly, with the best kind of journalist capacity for clarity and summation, the summarizing of complicated ideas in a way that we can understand. He analyzes eight possible scenarios. Actually, there are six scenarios, but a couple of them have subset scenarios within them. So it's beautifully presented in The Times by a very fine graphics team run by Ryan Wyatts and Daniel Clark at The Times on the production side of the paper. It's interactive. You can scroll over all these graphs and lines, or timelines that you can, so that you can just pinpoint exactly what it is you want to find out, and you will find out. And the categories of scenario range through, if the polls are right and it's a straightforward loss for Trump, then there's a scenario in which headlined Trump's silent majority fights back. There's another scenario in which the election result is not so different from 2016. A scenario in which there's a solid Biden victory. Another one in which there's a Biden landslide. And the interesting possibility that in some form or other the result is a tie. Now he gets into the murky weeds there, whether the popular vote and the electoral vote really align or not, and why not. So I think it's just one of those cases where a sudden spark has taken off and blazed into a really quite glorious piece of analysis in journalistic form. It's a long read, of course, but you can take your choice about which bits of it you want to concentrate on. It's neat because it's so neatly packaged and delivered. This is what we want from our best newspapers, and I'm glad to say that The Times, which I don't always approve of at all, I think it's a shadow of its former self in many ways, but in this case, it's a wonderful flash of glory, and I want to acknowledge it.
I can't let you leave without talking about the debate for a minute or two, because I was in a debate club when I was younger, and I know debate rules, and I've always complained that these debates are not debates. But I've always said also...
This one certainly was not.
I've also
argy-bargy, I think, is the word that comes to mind for me.
You know, I also said over the years that instead of relying on moderators to make the people stop talking when their time was up, you have to put a mute on your microphone, which I can't believe these networks can't afford. So when you
oh yeah, it'd be too expensive for NBC to put a mute button in. No, I think you're right, absolutely, and I think everybody in the country must acknowledge that. I mean, it's moderating a debate between an individual like Trump and anybody else is obviously going to be difficult. The basic mechanical device of silencing the person who refuses to be silenced by good grace or by persuasion. Verbal persuasion is an obvious idea. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but not unlike TED Talks, there is also a long tradition of debate in public and being broadcast called Intelligence Squared, which happens in Britain and also in the United States. And they have a very strict policy of just muting people if they get out of order. And it works very effectively.
Well, you know, it's just one of those things. I always said to myself, if he got elected, here's a guy who's been CEO of his own company for his whole life, and in a debate scenario, how do you silence a guy who thinks even he's in the debate? He's the CEO of the country. I mean, he is too ingrained in his style. It's just not going to change.
Well, he says he won't accept any changes to the rules, but. Who knows? Everything's up for grabs now. A little tiny virus has had that effect.
David, we'll see what happens. I hate to say this every week, but we'll see what happens in the next week here in this incredible year of 2020.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you next Friday.
All right, take care. David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. Of course, you can find David on the web at themediabeat.us, his own website. And he's also a PBS television correspondent who reports on ethics and belief.